Hey everyone, and welcome back to Purple Row Radio. My name is Greg Stanwood. I'm a staff writer at PurpleRow.com. I'm here along with the managing editor of Purple Row, Andrew Martin. My co-host, Andrew, how are you?
I'm alright. Decent Sunday, beautiful weather outside. Went and saw a movie, just good things like that.
This is the second Sunday.
People's Fair is downtown, though.
This is the second Sunday in a row that I am going to say I just had a rotten day and leave it at that.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. But
went out of the People's Fair today, and man, I don't know what it is about the People's Fair. Like any fair or anything going on downtown in Denver, it's fun, sort of. It's the kind of thing where it's like, hey, I can't afford to do anything else, so I might as well go down to the People's Fair. And every year it's like the same crappy cover bands, and I know that they're all musically talented and they do a good job, but it's one band that's really funky and plays all the funky music, and then another band that plays everything you've ever heard on classic rock radio, and then another weird random hippie band that plays non-offensive music that's really, really boring to listen to. So I walked around there for about 20 minutes, and I'm like, yeah, well, I'm going to leave now. And I was actually looking for my friend's band playing down there, and it turns out they're playing at a venue called City Hall. Not City Hall itself, but a venue called City Hall. So I was just confused as hell. And I'm walking back towards my parking spot on like 11th and Broadway, and I suddenly hear this, hear something that sounds kind of like their band. I was like, wait a minute. I look across the street and there's, a venue called City Hall. I was like, oh. I walked in and there they are. Oh, well, I feel stupid. I'm walking around for 45 minutes trying to find them.
Brilliant.
But overall, good music though. Good times. Sorry your day wasn't as, not bad as mine.
Yes. Well, let's get to some baseball talk here. Later on in the show, I'm going to put in the interview we did with John Gennaro, who is a SB Nation San Diego-based writer. He writes for the Chargers blog, but we'll be talking, obviously, about the Padres and the upcoming series. But to get some stuff out of the way first, there was a little bit of news. We have, over the past week since we last recorded, we have filled three slots on the 40-man roster, which was a little faster than I expected. But let's talk about the simplest one first, the most recent. We did end up finally calling up Rex Brothers to the Rockies, and we haven't seen him pitch yet, have we, or did he pitch today?
No, he did not pitch today.
Okay.
We saw Jason Hamill and Matt Lindstrom, and that was all there was to it.
Gotcha. Yeah, I was listening on the radio today, so I didn't hear, every single thing that was going on. But he was warming up at one point, I think.
He might have been. I was having to follow mobile as well. I listened to some of it, watched a little bit of it, and then had to follow the rest of it on my phone. And, not the greatest day in Rockies baseball. Then again, we've had an awful lot of those this season.
Yeah, no, there have not been a lot of great days in general. But, I think a lot of people were kind of expecting Brothers to be the first choice to come up when Franklin Morales was traded. They ended up going with Matt Daly anyway. But Daly has now hurt his shoulder, I believe.
Yeah, bad case of getting hit all over the parkitis.
Maybe, although from the descriptions, he seems to have some legit pain going on.
No, I don't really doubt that he has pain in his shoulder. That's probably, because apparently it sprung back up after the St. Louis series. And, I wouldn't doubt that that was a part of, his six innings of terrible so far. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to be too hard on the guy, but I would like to see what he could do still healthy. I mean, he's the kind of, He's good depth to have, like a lot of people have been saying on the site, and mm-hmm. His AAA numbers were great up until the week before his call up when they were absolutely terrible, and then he gets called up and has like one good inning and then is absolutely terrible. And I'm not sure. Again, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and say it was injury related, but I just wouldn't be shocked if hey, there's a book on him now. His deceptive delivery isn't as great as it was his rookie year. Well, good luck out there, Matt.
Yeah, there certainly is, although he would still kind of have an advantage because, teams haven't really seen a lot of him recently. He didn't play very much last year, even though he got pretty much a full year of service time. He was hurt all year, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, when it actually comes to Daly, we still have a semi-open spot in the bullpen, but I think that the way things have been going, they feel a little bit more inclined to actually keep a proper long reliever type in there now, at least for the time being. So, you know, even when he gets healthy, there might not be a spot for him anymore, if especially if Brothers sticks. But I'm certainly looking forward to seeing him pitch, but I always say this when we call up you know, the Chris Nelsons and so forth, you know, free Chris Nelson. Well, what are Rex Brothers or Chris Nelson or Eric Young Jr. or any of these people really going to do? What kind of spark can they do? They're not going to sum it all up. My point is they're not saviors.
No. And a lot of people have been using the, you know, the analogy of rearranging deck chairs in the Titanic. It's a little early to say the season's completely over, because I mean, 2007 and 2009 happened, and I'm not trying, those are, 2007 was a once in a, you know, franchise kind of run, you know?
Once in like 30 franchises, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. We've only seen a couple teams do anything close to what the Rockies did in 2007, or, you know, and then 2009 was more of a, you know, season-long sigh of relief that immediately turned into dominant offensive and, you know, pitching performance. but now it's one of those things where there's no real hard explanation. 2007 just wasn't supposed to happen. It was just magic. Everyone knows it was magic, and everything just kept happening magically. There wasn't one particular problem that needed to be solved, per se. I mean, they called up Jimenez and Morales, obviously, and both of them did their thing, and it was super exciting to watch, and yay for these magical saviors.
And of course, as we've both mentioned before on this very show, we had already had our share of problems that season, and not only did we call up some you know, legit prospects like Jimenez and Morales, but we had to kind of, you know, we had some sort of weak spots on the team there for a little while that were kind of strung together with duct tape, if you know what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah,
and,
absolutely.
You know, that was the year where I think within the span of, like, 2 weeks, we acquired, like, Ramon Ortiz and Elmer Dessens and...
Yeah, I remember one of Elmer Dessens' last starts. He was about to lose his spot in the rotation, too, and then he went and got himself... He pitched, like, 3 or 4 good innings and then got hurt, and Mark Redmond stepped up to the plate, or I guess... It was just absurdity. 2007 was absurdity, and it was almost Giants-esque. Mm-hmm. Every hit fell, every washed-up whoever suddenly sprung to life again, and when they tried to lean on them again in 2008, it obviously all fell apart. But then 2009, the obvious problem was Clint Hurdle, and not any particular thing he did, although everyone got very angry at him for benching Tulowitzki. It was very clear that his time with the Rockies was done, and I don't mean that in a Clint Hurdle is terrible kind of way, but I've said this many times before, probably a billion times in this show too, but Clint Hurdle was more of a developmental manager. He takes this team that is full of young guns and some talent and a couple veterans and, you know, basically force them to play as a cohesive unit, and that's what he was good for, is basically getting minor leaguers who have been in the majors for a couple of years a year or two, teach them how to be major leaguers. And then past that, it's like, okay, now what? And that's where Jim Tracy stepped in. And I maintain that managers don't have that big of an impact on, you know, actual season results. But it was clear the team was ready to get off their training wheels and actually start riding on their own. And the minute they took those training wheels off, I mean, they went to the playoffs again. It was very exciting. But now, 2011, what's the problem? What specifically is the problem? Well, the bats aren't working. You're talking about a good number of roster spots here. You're talking about 8 starters and, you know, 4 bench players. We can't just say, oh, well, we got to replace all the bats. That's just silly talk, because you can't just go and trade the entire team away. It's absurdity. What's wrong? I don't know. Is Tulowitzki's getting unlucky? Gonzalez is striking out too much? None of the supporting cast is doing their job right? Everybody who looked to be making strong steps forward is kind of regressing, except for Iannetta and Seth Smith. And Iannetta just kind of doing what we got to expect out of Iannetta, hitting for low average, hitting the occasional gigantic home run, and walking a lot. His defense has stepped up, too. So, you know, kudos to Iannetta for, you know, keeping up his offensive line, but making himself more noticeable in a positive light to the organization. And Seth Smith, same kind of thing. You know, good work being offensively strong, even though he's been, again, god-awful the last couple days here.
Right.
Everybody gets their hiccups, but when it's a two-month hiccup, you kind of... It sounds more like indigestion, you know?
Hmm.
It's tough to pinpoint one particular thing that's wrong with 2011. And a lot of people say, well, this is what you call a, you know, a bad team, or they're showing their true talent. Give me a break. There's no way that Troy Tulowitzki's true talent level is where he is right now. There's just no way. I mean, I was very suspicious of how much of his offensive production came in September last year. And, you know, I got a lot of people criticizing that, too. And it wasn't me saying they don't count. It just has me raising an eyebrow of, do we have to wait till September for Tulowitzki to be, you know, Captain Amazing?
Well, and at the same time, I don't expect that anybody thinking clearly would have assumed that, you know, that, I mean, just like you're saying now with 2011, this isn't indicative at all of his true talent level. Well, neither was September of last year.
That was
absurd, absurdly productive. And, you know, it might have padded his, statistics up quite significantly, especially after missing that 6 weeks or so with the wrist, or I guess it was just four that he ended up missing. But, you know, I don't think that, the fact that he, had such a crazy month there at the end should really, either propel or diminish people's expectations of him, because I think, he was doing pretty good before that anyway.
Yeah, and Tulo's just one player to look at, obviously. Cargo's the other big problem. I said earlier, he's swinging on everything and just looking terrible, but you don't, you don't put up the kind of numbers he did in 2010 without having some high level of talent. I mean, yeah, people get lucky a lot, but I mean, he didn't just get lucky. He was a triple crown threat until about the middle of September, when it was pretty clear that there's no way he's gonna, you know, get enough home runs to surpass, I think it was Votto and Pujols ahead of him, and so on and so forth. But triple crown contender and won the batting title. There's something good going on there, and a lot of it was good home performance, very, very, very good home performance, and, you know, a lot of luck as well on batted balls in play, but he's not a 240 hitter. The guy's going to be a much better hitter throughout the course of his career, and I really just wonder if it's a case, and a lot of people have been wondering this too, is it just the fact that Tulo and Cargo got their giant contracts, and now they feel they have to play up to contract levels? That's all I can really think, and that's kind of where I'm hanging my hat right now, is that the two of them are just trying to be the team, and it's not working, and they are sort of lost in not knowing how to handle their own lack of very strong performance. I mean, Tulowitzki has been good. Not Tulowitzki good, but he's been far from the problem. His defense has been great, but offensively he's been well above average. Just not in that echelon of really, really good, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And with the two of them struggling the way they are, I mean, they say, oh, well, they're going to snap out of their funk. In the meantime, we need to win games. What about you, supporting cast? And Helton and Smith shrug, and everyone else strikes out.
Whoops. Yeah.
I guess Wigginton knew. Wigginton has come into the last week or two of May and the first week of June and has been crushing it. He's opting over 1,000 over that time frame, and he's just been very, very good. And I don't think it's going to last. I mean, everyone knows it's not going to last. I mean, with a guy with as much baseball history behind him as he has right now, the book's kind of there on Ty Wigginton as well. But considering the black hole that everyone has noticed, I will take the daylights out of his production. And I mean, even if he's not defensively great, he's defensively something. He's slightly better. He's better than a statue. He's not just a scarecrow standing at third base. He's been able to make some good plays. And he's just kind of a, I don't know, blue-collar defenseman. I can't find a better way to put it than that.
Hmm.
Not, you know, a defensive, you know, not an Adrian Beltre at third base, and, you know, not a Casey Kochman or Todd Helton at first base. But he's good enough. He's better than Giambi. We can put it that way.
Sure.
If we kept going through the entire lineup here, we could find guys who are doing better than they should be doing or worse than they should be doing and point fingers at players and all that, but there is just something hanging over this team right now. I mean, everybody I talk to who's been to games recently looks in the dugout, or if they can see the dugout, and the guys just look deflated. And it's almost getting to the point where we had a joke, I think it was in a rock pile a couple weeks ago, or maybe even more recently than that, where people were saying this is shaping up to be, you know, a very stereotypical sports movie where they all need to find that one thing, you know, go play wiffle ball in the park or you know, rollerblade to the mall or just whatever silly thing needs to happen to get them all to realize, hey, life is fun. Let's have fun. And then they all of a sudden go and just dominate on the baseball field. There's no explanation for any of this. I don't know what to say.
We should buy them a bouncy castle to keep in the clubhouse.
I bet. I'm sure they'd be down with that.
That's certainly entertaining, right?
Yeah, and I wonder if there's just one thing that we haven't heard that we're all missing. You know, maybe Dexter Fowler needs the brown rice and white toast that he didn't want. Maybe he needs that one. I don't know.
He likes the white rice and the brown toast. I always remember that because I eat brown rice, so he likes the opposite kind of rice that I like.
I would like the brown rice and the brown toast. There's just more flavor there. Maybe that's what Dexter Fowler needs. There's more flavor. Because, honestly, and I'm not saying there's any inkling that this is going to happen necessarily. Well, that's not true, because Thomas Harding actually kind of slowly hinted at the thought that Fowler's struggles at the plate have not gone unnoticed. He went from leadoff to 2 when Eric Young came up. Well, actually 8 before that. Then he had a couple games in the 2, but he's not playing good baseball right now. And there's question marks about whether they need to bring up Charlie Blackmon in his stead.
Well, that actually is a good lead in to the other two spots that were filled up, because once Cook is activated and we're back up to 40, you know, we basically have one more spot left because we can move De La Rosa to 60, to the 60-day disabled list. I should be more clear.
The Reds haven't done it yet, frankly.
Well, they have no reason to. Like, I mean, I understand completely why they didn't, because even though there's, like, okay, if you fill up a wall of all zeros and then, a 1 at the end and then put a point at the beginning, even if there's that little chance that he has, like, a miracle recovery or something, you know, why not be safe when just keep him on the 15-day until you absolutely know for sure that he needs... 60-day. I mean, basically the only reason to move a player to the 60-day, the only difference is an extra roster spot, and you can do that whenever you want. So, you know,
that's a good point. It seemed like a foregone conclusion to me, and yeah, I guess I don't put much stock into miracles when an MRI says, oh, hey, your elbow's snapped.
I mean, I would understand if there were like some rule that you could only pick one or the other or something, but literally, there's no restriction there. You just change the number and you have a new roster spot. So they could fill a spot like that with Charlie Blackmon or somebody like that. There's still that one extra spot, even though they're kind of half filled up, or I guess all filled up at this point, or will be when Cook is activated. What day is he starting? I can't remember. Yeah, is it Wednesday?
I think so. You had to go and put me on the spot, didn't you? I just don't know.
Let me bring up the probable pitchers list real quick, and I will figure it out. He is starting Wednesday against Dustin Mosley.
Okay, that should be an interesting start, especially when you hear about what John has to say about Dustin Mosley.
Yes, in the future, what he will have to say. Wink. No.
What he is going to say in the interview we had already.
Yes.
Come on, we're not fooling anyone here, Greg.
No, I'm obviously not. I mean, it's just kind of strange to talk about things out of order like that, but. Yeah, so actually, we can talk really quickly about the two other players we picked up. We claimed two players off waivers, and it's kind of amusing because they are Ryan Rollinger, who is a third baseman, and Josh Roenicke, who is a relief pitcher. And not only do they have kind of similar, strange R-starting last names, but they're actually surprisingly similar in a lot of ways. First of all, I mean, we'll get into who they are in a minute, but they have within 5 days of service time of each other, which I thought was immediately strange. And then I found out, and not only that, they came from essentially the same, I mean, they've had almost the same developmental history, despite being completely different, types of players. The only major difference is, you know, Roenicke's already with his third organization, and this is just Rollinger's second. But they're both in the same situation where they have – they're in the middle of their last option year, and they could qualify for a bonus one but probably won't. So not only do they have about the same major league time, they basically have just about the same minor league time too, which is – just one of those bizarre things you notice when you have to look up all these numbers like I do. But
did they get officially assigned anywhere yet?
Oh yeah, they were both optioned to Colorado Springs.
That's kind of it.
Roenicke. Go ahead.
I just want to say that's very interesting. The assignment. Give. I mean, pitching. Sure, whatever. I mean, you just lost. Is Roenicke lefty or righty?
He's a righty, and
okay. Well,
he's already joined the team. Rollinger hasn't. See, the way this works is, obviously you can't just teleport the players from where they were playing before to Colorado Springs. So that's the reason why that reserve list exists. So, I mean, we can't just keep the players in limbo, like, officially, but we also can't, like, expect them to play for the team when they're not there yet. So they got optioned to the team, and then they sat on the reserve list until they showed up. And Josh Roenicke came yesterday, and he pitched in the game, actually. I think he pitched one inning with a walk and no runs. So, but Rollinger is still off doing whatever he's doing in between transitioning, I guess.
Well, whatever it is he's doing, the question I'm more asking is, what exactly do they want him for? Not that having extra depth isn't a good thing, but, I mean, you got Josh Fields, Ian Stewart, and now Ryan Rollinger.
Yeah, third base is definitely a little bit of an awkward spot there. I mean, I don't know necessarily if they intend to play him at third base necessarily regularly, because he can play pretty much everywhere in the infield. But his development up until this point has been as a third baseman, and any other places he's moved around have really been kind of, you know, just... I mean, in the minors, sometimes they need you to play here or there or anywhere. I mean, we've seen Josh Fields in the outfield a couple times, for example, and he's not an outfielder, but, you know, they were down on outfielders that day. So,
yeah,
I mean, I'm definitely, I mean, I can't say I'm necessarily excited about either player, because they're both essentially depth moves. I mean, basically, to me, I'm sitting in Dan O'Dowd's chair, I would be thinking, gosh, we have all these extra 40-man spots. Hey, here's a couple of waiver claims that are like 5% interest, or 5 interesting on the 10 scale. Might as well grab them, and if we need a roster spot again, it's not really going to hurt to bounce them away again. In fact, that happens a lot. If you watch waiver claims, it's very common for them to be after one team claims them, like 2 weeks later, they get claimed by somebody else. It happened to Shane Lindsay, who was claimed away from us in 2009, I think. And then he was claimed by, I guess, the Yankees, and then he was claimed away, or no, he was claimed by the Indians, and then claimed by the Yankees. One of those two. But,
yeah. It was an odd little cycle. I think he got the Yankees first, then the Indians.
Oh, I guess the reason I got it backwards is because the Indians would have had first shot at him, and I guess they passed on him the first time, and then they claimed him the second time. Which I guess might make sense, like if the first time they didn't have a roster spot, and then the second time they did, maybe. But, yeah, that's just one of those weird things that when a player is claimed off waivers, it's gotta be pretty shocking, like maybe even more so than a trade, because, you know, in Rollinger's case, maybe not, because he was designated for assignment, so he knew he was gonna be, you know, changing his, in the place where he was playing professionally, probably. But, Roenicke was just on the AAA team in Las Vegas for the Blue Jays. And, you know, there's no designation for assignment. They just up and told him, hey, you got claimed. Drive to Colorado Springs. So,
oh, awkward.
Yeah. But yeah, that's basically what has happened to all those spots. I don't know if you have any other thoughts on those players. We don't really have much to say on them at this point, but, you know.
There's not really much to say. It's their depth moves. If someone else gets hurt, they're, you know, might be next in line or something like that. But, I mean, I really just kind of scratch my head about third base. I'm wondering, no, that's stupid to say. I'm wondering if it's a precursor to a trade, but we're not talking about, you know, the major league results here. We're talking about AAA Colorado Springs and, like, the fourth or fifth man on the depth chart.
Well,
so,
if you read some of the forums, like at Inside the Rockies or just maybe a couple of other places, the comment sections around the Rockies internet sphere, a lot of people get really trade happy or overly speculative about trades when things like this happen. So there were definitely some people who were like, oh, we're going to trade Eric Young, or we're going to trade Josh Fields or something like that. And it's just like, you know, they had the room. These players passed by. Why not pick them up for now? And then, as I said, a lot of times they're going to be the first ones who are cut from the roster if they need more space. So, whatever, basically.
it's not going to hurt anything to bring these guys in, obviously. But, yeah, I think we've talked enough about minor league depth in this particular case.
Okay.
Do we want to move to interview from here, or do we have another topic we want to jump on first?
I wanted to talk about the Buster Posey stuff first.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure most of the two of you who are listening, which means one or one and a half of you, I guess, have heard all the wackiness going on about the fallout relating to the Buster Posey injury. I know that you said before while we were planning that you didn't have a strong opinion on it, but why don't you share your thoughts first?
I'm the one who doesn't have a strong opinion, but
I know.
It's an unfortunate play. We've seen this 2 years in a row with a tough collision at the plate. We saw the Indians' Carlos Santana get his, you know, knee all busted up. Not nearly as bad as Posey's ankle, but, you know, definitely out for the season. And he's back now, and he's healthy and good things like that, and playing a little first, playing a little catcher. And but Buster Posey, a lot of people have said a lot of things about the way Posey's play went down. Again, unfortunate that he got hurt, but it was really questionable the way he decided to block the plate, the way his feet and legs were positioned, and then when he came back in to actually take the impact from Scott Cousins, he had his feet all out of whack, and he got folded over his own ankle and just tore it to pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'll say it again and again and again and again, very tragic. I have nothing against Buster Posey. I mean, yeah, he's a Giant. Boo, Giants. Rah. That's about the end of my distaste for Buster Posey. He's a young, exciting player, and he's the kind of guy that baseball needs, you know, a guy that leads his team to the World Series after a midseason call-up and exciting things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm never glad that a player gets hurt, because I never want to. Well, if the Rockies are to ever beat another team again, I like to say we beat them at their full strength. We stop them at full steam. We are a better team than they are. But when they're missing one of their best players, it clearly didn't hurt them that bad in this series. I mean, they couldn't score any runs, really, but
neither could we.
We somehow found a way to score less runs than the Giants, who are missing their best hitter, and we have both our best hitters healthy and terrible. As far as I'm sure we want to talk about the aftermath, if that's the direction we're driving this.
Yep, that's basically where I'm headed. I want to know what you think of the, some of the comments that people have been saying about the injury, and that includes people in the Giants organization and outside of the Giants organization and, you know, so on and so forth.
Well, I don't think there needs to be a rule change. I think somebody made the comment on Purple Row saying that they're afraid that this is going to make teams take hot catching prospects and just convert them really fast so they don't lose that guy in a home plate collision, and that all your catchers from here on out are going to start being Danny Ardoin type guys, Francisco Cervellis, the people that the organization doesn't have that much stock in, somewhat interchangeable. They want a guy who works well with a pitcher, and if he can hit, you know, if he can post a slightly below league average OPS or whatever, then he'll be, you know, just fine for them. They just want the defensive guy. They're just going to go for glove and game calling and not risk putting a big bat at catcher when they could put him at third base and not have to worry about those nasty home plate collisions. it's I think it's just unfortunate timing. I don't think it needs to be a rule change because, I mean, how many other catchers do we see get after? I'm kind of just shooting from the hip here. I don't have the numbers or the history of the injuries in front of me, but why all of a sudden now, because Brian Sabian's best young player gets hurt, do we need a rule change? A rule change last year when Carlos Santana got his knee broken, or, you know, torn or whatever. I think it was his MCL, if I recall correctly. But I didn't see Brian Sabian crying for it then, but now that it's his player, if it's Eli Whiteside, I question if he would have made as big of a stink about it.
Yep.
I think he's just pissed off that his young player got hurt. And then furthermore, the way he goes and suddenly throws himself into this immature fray about how, you know, putting up, this almost screams, Canucks versus Avalanche back, I think it was 02 or 03, where that horrible Steve Moore incident happened where Todd Bertuzzi sucker punched him and drove him into the ice and basically ended his career in one fell swoop. Obviously, there's a lot more malice there. It was entirely malicious. But with Scott Cousins, you saw him just, you know, destroy Posey at the plate. And if he hadn't gotten hurt, everyone would have just been like, oh, damn, that's a big hit. And that's the end of it right there. But it turns out he got horribly injured. If you watch the replay of it, you see Scott Cousins, the first person over, like, oh, my God, are you okay, man? I mean, you obviously can't read his lips there. But he is clearly not like, yeah, that's right, I scored the run. Going, you know, fist pumping his way back to the dugout or whatever, getting high fives from everyone. He was the first one there to say, oh, my God, are you okay? He was clearly thinking, oh, my God, I just really hurt Buster Posey. I was just making the tough play. I didn't mean anything by it. It's very obvious. And when they asked Scott Cousins how he felt about Brian Sabian practically putting a price out on his head, he said that he's pretty sure that Brian Sabian's not the only person. That opinion is held by the majority of baseball. He didn't do anything dirty, folks. Buster Posey did not position himself right for the play. If Buster Posey had done what he was supposed to do, it would have just been a big hit. He would have fallen back on himself, maybe held the ball. Actually, he didn't have the ball in control. He would have lost the ball, run scores. He's shaken up. Maybe comes out of the game just because he lost his breath or whatever, and would have been starting the next day, been just fine. But instead, Buster Posey put himself in a very awkward position to try to absorb a large hit from a guy barreling down from third base. And it's kind of a no-fault scenario because it was an accident, but if we had to put fault on anyone, I almost put it on Buster Posey. Do position yourself right. I mean, freak accident, and don't take this to me be literally saying, well, Buster Posey brought that upon himself. No, it was unfortunate, but that's kind of the end of it. It was a horrible accident, and I'm very disgusted might be a bit of a strong word, but I'm less than impressed with the way the Giants brass is handling this situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well,
so
basically, when it comes to me and my interpretation of Brian Sabian and what's been going down here, first, I will say that I will defend him to a certain point. Sabian, yes.
Yeah, okay.
I will agree that the fact that this is suddenly such an issue for him reeks of a double standard, but at the same time, you know, it's also kind of a wake-up call. And I'm not a baseball traditionalist, right? I'm not going to feel really sad for baseball tradition if there's some massive rule change where, you know, collisions at the plate are no good anymore. I don't even know really how that would work. I'm not going to be bothered by that personally. I'm not necessarily in favor of it for any reason, but at the same time, I understand and empathize with the guy that he just saw his best player taken out, you know, long term, a young kid who didn't deserve such a sad ending to a season. I can understand how that can change. That can make you feel really upset and how it might make you look for ways that might have been avoided. So, okay, if he wants to opine or, you know, spout off about being in favor of a rule change, even if it's for, you know, the selfish reasons that it's his own star player that it happened to and it never would have woken him up or gotten him involved with the issue if it were any other catcher, I still can understand that. But I absolutely agree with you that when it comes to the weird comments that he's had, the hostile comments, and I think they're blatantly hostile, that he's said towards Scott Cousins, I think it's absurd. I think it's incredibly immature, and I was really put off when he said, like, oh, we've got a long memory. I wouldn't be sad at all if I never saw him play in the majors again. I mean, come on. Come on. You didn't just say that. But even out of anger, I don't think that that makes any sense. And
no,
if there's any actual fallout, like if the next time that Scott Cousins as a Marlin or wherever, or faces a Giant wherever they are, if there's some sort of heat going on there, if the Giants throw at him or do some other, you know, mischievous, hostile action, I'm gonna be sick to my stomach.
It depends on what we mean by hostile action. If we talk about something really nasty, yeah, that's pretty disgusting.
Well, you already know that I have pretty high standards, or I guess you could say pretty low standards, for what constitutes really nasty. I think there are a lot of things in professional sports that are really nasty to me that everybody else just takes for granted. So, if they so much as throw near him, I'm going to be pissed off.
Well, see, baseball has its way of policing these things, and there's two ways to look at it, because there's one thing that if the Giants really honestly think that he did this maliciously, I mean, Lincecum, you know, drills him with a fastball on the hip or something like that, and he gets a nice big, you know, bruise all over his rear and trots his way to first base and whatever. That should be the end of it. We see this all over the place. It's this whole machismo, chivalrous, whatever. I don't even know how to describe it anymore. But, I mean, think about it. I think it was 2 years ago where Prince Fielder did his whole bowling ball walk-off thing, and the Brewers, you know, fell over, and it was really hilarious. And then Barry Zito plunked him in spring training or something like that.
I know.
Things are supposed to end. I mean, I'm not saying I approve of it, but that's what happens. That's the mentality that these players have. It's a very...
I can't even defend any of those things. Like, speaking again personally, I'm not a professional baseball player. I don't speak for them in terms of what should or should not offend somebody. But the goofy little Brewers thing was, okay, it was a little bit, you know, corny, if you will. Maybe a little bit, showing off a bit, if you will. But, that's all it is to me, a bit.
I thought that, I mean, this is rehashing really old stuff. I just thought it was arrogant, and I don't know. The NBA does stuff like that. I don't like the NBA or anything about it.
Well, I don't either.
And I don't want baseball to start turning into that. And that's, I mean, when Prince Fielder hit that walk-off against the Rockies, as he was doing his home run trot, I was thinking, oh, I swear to God, if they do something choreographed, I hope he takes one in the hip next time. And which is just, again, immature on my part there, but
yes.
Don't pull that crap. I mean, if you honestly, even, like, why would you rehearse something like that?
Only speaking for myself, not trying to tell you or the Giants how they should feel, but it doesn't bother me in the slightest. I am the type of person that would not have been offended by that, and also would probably not have involved myself in actually doing it. So, you know, it's not like I'm necessarily defending the Brewers. It's just, to me, I guess it's just like a naive wish that I have that they just stop throwing at each other. Makes me crazy.
I don't think that there's any, from where I'm standing, and again, I'm taking the side of Scott Cousins, or at least defending Scott Cousins, because he clearly didn't mean to do this. He clearly did not mean to end Buster Posey's season. However, here we are. I can just see the team. I don't know how to describe it, because I'm trying not to paint the entire organization with, again, these broad brushes, but they seem to be a very young isn't the right word, but the kind of team that would let itself get somewhat caught up in these kind of antics. And I mean, because remember, if you remember last year during the whole Humidor debacle, when Tim Lincecum didn't even know what he was complaining about, the stupid juice balls, and and then throws back an overly heavy ball. It's, you've got to be joking me. You don't even know what you're upset about, do you? I can see Lincecum being the one to drill Scott Cousins if the plate appearance actually occurs in that fashion. Because you just know that he's a bit of a hothead who, I don't want to say he doesn't think things through, because that's a bit of an unfair statement to make about someone I don't personally know, but given his track record so far, and just the way his persona seems to be displaying itself, I would not be surprised if there any retaliation would come off the arm of Tim Lincecum. But even if they feel the need, they have to. I sincerely hope that they can get their, you know, they can flex themselves enough by hitting him, by hitting this guy once, and then that's the end of it. It's like, all right, dude, we know you didn't mean to do it, but we gotta throw it at you anyways. If there's any retaliation, frankly, on Scott Cousins, I'll just think it's the most stupid thing. Not because I don't approve, not because I'm trying to get angry about all retaliation, but I don't know. Would you throw at the next guy who slides hard in the second or takes out your shortstop? Not for the season, but, you know, knocks your shortstop over? No, that's, I don't know. There's a line between malice and tough and playing the game really hard. And Scott Cousins was clearly on the I'm playing the game hard side of that dividing line. And I sincerely, for his sake and for baseball's sake in general, hope that it is interpreted that way going forward. What's been said is said, and, well, I just don't like Brian Sabian very much.
Well, I didn't have any feelings for him one way or the other until he said that. So certainly leaning negative now. But I going back to that other thing you mentioned about that Lincecum statement, I was the only person on the blog who was defending him at that point. So, you know.
Why?
Because, okay, I actually can argue this one pretty well. Do you remember Jeff Cirillo and what he did? Okay, well, the nice thing about Lincecum is, compared to what Cirillo did, Cirillo, you know, basically made a whole issue out of it after the game and spouted off a whole bunch of nonsense that was obviously just going through his head out of frustration and didn't even attempt to stop and rationalize himself. He just went crazy with it. He spouted off a whole bunch of nonsense. Lincecum made one offhand comment on the mound, was a little touchy about it afterwards, and then dropped it. Didn't bring anything up. He's not still out there saying, you know, oh, I'm certain that those were, you know, juice balls. He did not campaign against anybody for it like Cirillo did. That's the way I feel about it.
True enough. And when I say that the things I say about Lincecum and that regarding that situation were more, like I said, this is me being armchair psychologist here, which is one of those things that I hate, but here I am doing it. Just the way he reacted to that kind of, for me, put him, you know, showed him in the light of guy who just wants to be part of the mob mentality and be pissed off with the rest of the team, although he doesn't really know what he's pissed off about.
Well, yeah, and I absolutely agree with that. Although, I think my point is, when you're out on the mound in the middle of a baseball game, I mean, he said that to himself. And it was just, I can't remember what happened. Did they just homer off him or something like that?
I don't even remember.
Well, either way, I mean, he didn't scream it. All he did was say it, and the TV cameras picked it up. Otherwise, we never would have heard about it at all. And that's what I mean, where it was a moment of anger on his part and foolishness. And, I mean, I agree with you that it was just a frustrated player who was looking for some scapegoat of an idea to brush that off onto. But that was the end of it. He didn't need to go out and, you know, say to the media or to anybody else, you know, oh, this was a juiced ball. It felt wet or whatever. And then, I mean, that's just the exact opposite of what Jeff Cirillo did with kind of the same thing. And if Lincecum had done that, I would have been mad, but he didn't. So,
but you know why I'm saying this, though, that he doesn't even know what he's mad about, because it wouldn't be. Why would he be upset about a juice ball that was heavier and harder to get hit out of the park?
Right.
That's what I don't understand. That's the whole situation. I mean, if it was a dry ball, yeah, throw a fit. but for an overly heavy ball, it's going to be harder. Yeah, whatever.
I'm sorry. I do agree with you on that point. I think that's what he was doing. I just don't really get upset with the player for that unless he takes it a step farther. So.
And he did. And I'm not even upset. I mean, when I say upset, I just, again, it seems to show his character. Anyways, blah, blah, blah. I really hope it blows over fast for Scott Cousins' sake.
All right. Well, as it goes with this episode, I guess we've just spouted off a whole bunch of opinions about all sorts of things, and this is good news for all of those people out there who have been for a year and a half waiting for us to debate some of these issues or whatever. Usually we shy away from it, but I guess bringing up the Posey thing kind of led to a bunch of other ones. So, with that out of the way, why don't we go to the interview we recorded with John, and we will close out after that. Okay, we have John Gennaro on the line. John is the managing editor of Bolts from the Blue, which is the SB Nation San Diego Chargers blog, but he is also an unofficial contributor to Gaslamp Ball, which is the San Diego Padres blog. John, thanks for joining us today.
Not a problem.
Okay, Andrew, I know you've got some questions lined up, so why don't you take the first question there.
All right, so John, with the NL West seeming to be a complete free-for-all at this point, with teams like the Diamondbacks performing better than expected and the Rockies drastically underperforming right now, where do you think the Padres are going to be in this race? It still seems to be anyone. I mean, it's only June, of course, but, you know, even looking forward, this is going to be anyone's division, you know, down to the last couple weeks of September. Where do you think the Padres are going to, you know, finish this race?
Yeah, I mean, luckily, you know, everyone in the division is still pretty close together in terms of no one's really blowing away all the other teams. So they obviously still have a shot if they can pick it up. I mean, they had a really bad April. They were about 500 in the month of May. And, you know, they're hoping that June gets a little bit better. It seems like what they're sort of realizing now is that they lack that one really strong bat that day in, day out can, you know, affect the rest of the lineup and maybe scare pitchers a little bit. So it seems like what they're thinking of doing is waiting until the deadline to avoid the Super 2 thing, which I think is June 9th or June 10th. And they're going to call up Anthony Rizzo, who's batting about 380 with great power and a ton of RBIs in AAA, and insert him at first base and sort of go the same route that the Giants went last year when they called up Buster Posey, and just hope that the rookie comes up, the rookie gets hot, and the pitching holds on, and that's enough to climb up and you know, do something. But they're running out of time with this as far behind as they are. They really, when he comes up, he has to immediately affect the lineup, the team, the pitching has to get, you know, a little bit better, although it has gotten better. It needs to get even better. And they need to, you know, get going in the right direction in the month of June. Otherwise, you know, it'll be a wasted season.
Now we can jump right into Rizzo from here. He's batting 377, 455, 738 in AAA right now with a 1.193 OPS and 16 home runs from the first base position. Like you said, they want to get him up once they can dodge that whole Super 2 thing. But what does this spell for Brad Hopp? Well, obviously being a cast off from the Rockies, and a former fan favorite, a lot of, people still want to see what, you know, Hopp has left in his tank in Major League Baseball, and it's not looking so great so far for the Padres. At least his performance with the Padres. Is he a DFA candidate, or would they relegate him to kind of a first base right field utility role?
Actually, that whole, like, you know, the Padres were terrible in April and about 500 in May. A big reason for that is Brad Hopp completely turned around. In the month of April, I think he batted, you know, somewhere around 100, 130 maybe, with no power whatsoever. In the month of May, he hit over 300, and I think he had four or five home runs, still striking out a little bit too much, but he's starting to turn into the hitter that they, you know, that they hoped for when they signed him. The thing is, he doesn't really have enough power, and he has that, and he's also been a really terrible fielding first baseman. So the stories that are coming out the last couple of days is now that Rizzo's probably about a week away from coming up, they're having Hop take lots and lots of fly balls, get used to the outfield again. And it looks like when Rizzo comes up, Hop's just going to move from starting first baseman to starting right fielder, because there's been a lot of uncertainty with the spot in right field. And Hop, you know, as good as he's been in May, is probably the Padres' second or third best hitter right now. They can't really afford to DFA him or even put him on the bench. So I don't know what his outfield defense is like. You guys would know better than me, but I heard some horror stories. But it looks like in about a week, well, he's going to be moved to right field and Rizzo's going to come up and take over at first.
Well, interestingly enough, the UZR number suggests that Hop has actually been a positive fielder at first base, but we know that UZR isn't always the end-all to measuring a fielder's performance. As far as right field goes, well, if we go back to that UZR metric, Brad Hop actually graded out as one of the worst right fielders in all of Major League Baseball over the past, you know, 4 or 5 years. He has a very strong arm coming from right field, which any Rockies fan will attest to. You don't run on Brad Hop, and so that's going to add some level of defensive, you know, upgrade in right field by that. But as far as, you know, actually fielding the ball off the bat, you be prepared for some very interesting play out there. But so if Brad Hop is moving to full-time right field, I personally don't see how you take Kristen Orfea's bat just overall the season out of the lineup. And then Ryan Ludwig's actually been relatively decent this season. How do you see the outfield shaking out between Ludwig, Maben, D'Onofrio, and Hop?
Honestly, as good as D'Onofrio's bat has been, and he's, you know, been the consistent guy that has hit over 300 and sort of forced his way into the starting lineup by doing so, and he's adding a little bit of pop now and all that, but I think they look at D'Onofrio and they realize that he's sort of on a hot streak right now. It's going to be very difficult for him to maintain what he's been doing. And I think, you know, he's going to be back to being relegated as the fourth outfielder. I think, you know, he'll get a few starts in center, although he's a really poor, you know, outfielder or really poor center fielder. He can play right and left okay. But I think it'll end up being where he's splitting time with Brad Hop in right field. Every time we face a lefty, D'Onofrio will get a start there. If Ludwig needs a day off, D'Onofrio will get a start there. You know, if Maven gets hurt or needs a day off, they might even stick him out there. But I think D'Onofrio is going to be the one that sort of gets pushed from starting right fielder to fourth outfielder.
Well, that's you know, it definitely gives a more clear view of the Padres outfield. Let's move on from the bats then, unless there's something particular you wanted to speak about regarding the lineup.
Nothing I can think of off the top of my head.
Well, the story with San Diego always seems to be pitching because of a combination of, well, just flat-out good pitching talent, and then the pitcher-friendly nature of Petco Park. So far, the rotation's been a little surprising how things have panned out. We've seen Aaron Harang be, you know, decent. As far as some of the metrics go, Tim Stoffer might be looked at. Or is it Stoffer?
It's Stoffer.
Okay, Stoffer. I'm sure he's been getting that his entire life.
Yes.
And many frozen food jokes. Anyhow, yes. In his 12 starts, he's posted a 3.99 ERA, which isn't very good for Petco standards, but a 3.24 FIP and a 3.18 xFIP, suggesting that his numbers might be a bit inflated. And he's been, by Fangraphs WAR, the most valuable pitcher on the Padres staff at one right now. The surprising pitchers have been Clayton Richard and Matt Latos, both who struggled this season with Richard with an ERA of 4.52 and Matt Latos with an ERA of 3.97. And Richard is grading out at replacement level at the moment, and Latos just kind of above it. And we've seen, you know, drop-offs in performance from the two of them. Can you enlighten us as to any reasoning behind, you know, the surprising underachievement?
Well, it's with both guys, they're both pretty young. I mean, Richard is you know, a few years older, I think 3 or 4 years older, and actually had almost a full season with Chicago and about half a season in San Diego before Matt even came up. But you got to remember, Matt's still about 22 years old, and I think Clayton's about 25. They're flat out, they're having problems with control. I mean, they both still have stuff, but they're having issues with control, which you know, different reasons. I don't know if anyone can really figure out what's wrong with Clayton Richard, and that's the more serious problem right now, because it looks like Matt Latos has turned a corner. In his last three starts, you know, he still had a little bit of struggle with control, but he's not, you know, accidentally serving up meatballs to people every now and then, which he was doing in the beginning. And his big problem, and both of these guys, a big problem for them is that the fielding behind them has been atrocious. Last year, the Padres were the best fielding team in baseball, pretty much. And that really helped the young guys out a lot. It got them out of a lot of jams. Obviously, you know, you weren't giving up as many hits. So this year, Latos was struggling with, you know, there would be an error and he would just sort of lose his head and give up like a home run with one or two guys on, something like that. He seems to be getting better at that. His stuff is getting better. His control's getting better. In his last outing, I think he only went five or six innings and sort of the same thing for Richard. They just got up there in pitch counts because, there's a sentiment going around that these guys are getting squeezed, although I'm not sure if I'm buying it. But Leto seems to be getting better. Richard is – no one really is sure what's wrong with him or if he's going to get better. But the rest of the rotation has been good, and the bullpen has been great as always. I think the fielding just needs to pick it up, and someone needs to get Clayton Richard to throw strikes again.
Yeah, a lot of teams have been pulling the squeeze thing, and I'm wondering if it's just, you know, recently with the advent of, you know, pitch effects and, you know, people following on mobile game day where they can see the strike zone that, you know, calls for umpires' heads have become more and more prevalent. And I mean, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with them. I mean, I hate it when people make a post-game excuse of, well, the umpire screwed us. Yeah, there's usually that one big play that changed the game or whatever, but both teams are typically playing with the same umpire, and everybody's looking with the home goggles. I mean, we watched Diamondbacks start where Ian Kennedy was getting squeezed all over the place, and yeah, the Rockies still lost, and then everyone complained about the strike zone. And both teams are getting the same strike zone, but I do wonder if there's a you know, decline in the quality of how umpires are calling their games in the last few years, because things are starting to become more and more and more apparent of, you know, people being unsatisfied with the way the games are being called. The bullpen, you did mention the bullpen's been fantastic. As far as, again, Fangraphs WAR goes, the Padres bullpen is second only to that supernatural Atlanta Braves bullpen. And when I say supernatural, I mean the Braves are at about a 3.5, you know, maybe 3.7 WAR, and the Padres are a full run behind that, and they're second in the majors. So not just to talk up Atlanta here, but, you know, the Padres bullpen has been absolutely excellent. They have, out of everybody who's come up and pitched for them this season, two guys have an ERA at 3 or above. Corey Lupke with
Lupke.
Okay, I had it right then. It's kind of an awkward name. Anyways, 3.81 ERA with FIP and XFIP numbers far below that. He's gotten some bad luck on balls in play here, but put up some excellent peripherals. The other guy with an ERA at 3 or above is Sam Deduna, who is up for only 3 innings with an exactly 3.0 ERA.
Another former Rocky as well.
Exactly. But the rest of the Padres' bullpen has been lights out, even with some disappointing performances. For example, Luke Gregerson has seen his strikeout numbers absolutely plummet this season, and yet his overall numbers, he's still got, you know, a sub-3 ERA. While we're mentioning Gregerson, is there anything going on particular with him that we're missing? He's a 9.85 strikeouts per 9 career pitcher, but he's below 5 strikeouts per 9 this season. It still works when you put it in context of a very low walk rate as well, but when you're expecting a high strikeout setup kind of guy, what's the deal with Gregerson?
I mean, it's kind of the same deal with the entire bullpen. I mean, I think if you look back statistically, the Padres' 2010 bullpen was one of the best bullpens in the last 25 years. And essentially, it's the same players that have the same talent this year. The only guys that are now missing are Eduardo Mojica or Edward Mojica, who was traded to Florida. And he was probably, you know, the one guy in the bullpen last year that really wasn't that good. And then Ryan Webb got traded, who was a young guy who's got a lot of stuff but can't really find the strike zone. And they replaced them with Chad Qualls and Corey Lupke, who's probably eventually going to become a starter. But the real difference with the bullpen this year and the bullpen last year is that the team isn't as good. And so you end up with a lot of innings for Lupke, who I don't know if he's technically a rookie this year. I think he probably is. But, you know, he was just thrown into the bullpen because they didn't have any other lefties. And he's learning and getting better as the season's going along. But they would have loved it if they could just, you know, use him for a batter here, a batter there, maybe an inning here. And what's happened is, since he's, you know, one of the few guys with some stamina in the bullpen, he's ending up getting a lot of two and a half innings, you know, appearances. And the same thing goes for Gregerson. Gregerson last year, I can't remember a time when he had more than a four out appearance. And this year we find he's pitching a lot of, you know, back-to-back innings, full innings. And that'll wear on you. I don't know if he has more innings this year than he had at this point last year, but he certainly had more two-inning appearances this year than he probably had all of last year. And that's just because the starting pitching, especially Clayton Richard and Matt Latos, has not been as good and has not been going as deep into games as the starting pitching last year.
So do you think we can put that more, unexpected reliever workloads more on the starting rotation than specifically Bud Black's management philosophy, or you know, is there something insider that Rockies fans are missing?
No, I mean, I think you can absolutely point the bullpen, you know, not being as great as it was last year on one luck. Like you said, you know, Corey Lukey's just having some bad luck. But it's on luck, but I think more than anything else is just on the starting pitching is not as good. And I think that's one of the reasons you can look at the Braves and say, oh, the Braves bullpen is great. The Braves bullpen is great, but their starters have been excellent. Tim Hudson's been great. Jar Jurgens is having the best year of his life. You know, Tommy Hansen's fantastic. So when you go to your relievers and say, hey, each one of you only needs to pitch an inning every night. No one has to pitch two, and, you know, no one's really going to be put in a bad spot. You start the inning, you finish the inning, you're done. To give your relievers that kind of routine, we saw it last year, is just going to make a bullpen work 10 times better than otherwise.
Interesting.
Going back to the rotation real quick, there was one other question I had for you. You guys picked up Dustin Moseley in the offseason, who was non-tendered by the Yankees last year. And I noticed that he leads your team in innings pitched right now, and it looks like that he has been providing at least some level of consistent quality. I was wondering if you could give us any impressions of what he's contributed so far to your season, and if you expect it to continue.
Flat out, he's been the best starting pitcher we've had this year. In terms of stuff, consistency, at one point he had, I think, his first like two, three starts, he hadn't even given up a run, and yet he somehow was like 0-3. The team has not given him any offense, and if he was getting any sort of offense whatsoever, you would hear stories left and right about, you know, where did this guy come from? Because last year with the Yankees, he was essentially a long reliever. I think he got a handful of spot starts. But this is a guy that Bud Black knew from Anaheim and really liked and brought him in and said, you know, look, I think we can really improve you. And his key has been he's got a sinker, and his sinker just gets ground balls by the dozens. So he's been fantastic. There's no reason to believe that he won't continue to be fantastic. And there's kind of a race right now. If the Padres don't turn it around by the end of June, if they're still in last place and looks like they can't do anything by the end of June, there's him and Aaron Harang are sort of fighting for the which one is going to be traded at the deadline thing, because there's going to be some team that's going to want a consistent starter, and both those guys have been pretty much the same. Right now, Moseley would be the better option, but one of those guys is going to get traded unless the Padres can move up in the standings a little bit.
Now, you mentioned trading. Obviously, the other player and high question for – or high probability being traded is Heath Bell. Is he going to get moved? Is it kind of a foregone conclusion at this point, given the bullpen strength, or is he the kind of guy that they want to keep around anyhow, despite a potentially low finish?
You know, it all depends on how the next month goes. I mean, if the Padres can really turn around the next month, I can see Jed Hoyer, the general manager, looking at it and saying, look, this guy's going to be a key to a run if he believes that there's a run in this team. And, you know, he's going to yield back a pretty decent draft pick when he leaves. Let's just hold on to him. But he, you know, he's in the last year of his contract. He's expensive. He's kind of old. And there's this belief that at some point he's going to break down. He hasn't done it yet, but he's a big guy. He throws really hard. He's been doing it for a while without really getting injured. And they don't really want to lock up this, you know, big old guy who throws hard for 3 or 4 years, because there's this belief that, you know, he could end up being really injury prone, you know, come a year or so from now. So they'll trade him if they don't have some sort of great June. They'll probably also trade Ryan Ludwig. And like I said, they'll probably trade either Harang or Moseley. And, you know, there's a couple other guys that could definitely be on that list as well. But those are the three main ones. And this whole month is going to determine, you know, once Anthony Rizzo comes up and we'll see where the team goes from there. That's really going to determine if they're buyers or sellers come, you know, July 31st.
It's really early after the trade. And this will be my last question for you here. But, you know, Gonzalez having signed a gigantic extension with Boston, how do you feel about the trade? We see Anthony Rizzo, obviously we've talked about him a lot today, but Casey Kelly has a 3.82 ERA in Double A, and Raymond Fuentes in High A ball doesn't have the greatest slash line, but he's also stolen 22 bags with a 3.57 on base percentage. How do you feel about it, you know, a couple months after the fact? I know it's, you know, still a bit early to tell because we haven't seen Kelly or Fuentes hit the majors, but just give me your early impressions, I guess.
I mean, when it comes right down to it, it's impossible not to love the trade because when you look at the options, it was either get some prospects or lose Adrian Gonzalez to free agency. They were not going to be able to afford anywhere near what he got from Boston, and that's what he was demanding. And they tried to talk contract extension with him. He told them the numbers, and they went, oh, boy. So the fact that he had them, you know, in that position, it's amazing they got as much as they did. I mean, Rizzo, from what he's doing in AAA, Rizzo looks like a 21-year-old version of Adrian Gonzalez. So if you can trade away, you know, expensive Adrian Gonzalez and maybe get a 21-year-old version of him for cheap, that's a win right there. Now add in a potential ace pitcher and, you know, a guy who looks like he has the potential to be a speedy, strong center fielder, you know, in a few years from now. I think you have to look at that and say win. There was really no option of keeping him around. So they got a really good deal since they got forced into it.
Very cool. Well, my last quick thought, and it's not even really a question, but I always talk about my sim leagues that I've played in the past, and I don't know how I did it, but I got like Sean Markham or you know, one of those pitchers from Toronto in as the Rockies, and then for some reason bounced them straight to San Diego, and the computer GM for San Diego says, "What's this? Yes, of course I'll trade my entire bullpen for these guys." And so I've had Joe Thatcher and Luke Gregerson in my bullpen and up to the year like 2019 or something like that, and I think Gregerson just finally got traded away as a, you know, veteran move. You got a younger guy coming up, but Joe Thatcher's still like the lefty to go to and has been for about 7 years for Colorado. So if, you know, you happen to talk to Jed Hoyer, tell him that we have these, you know, questionable pitchers that I'm sure he'd love to acquire and trade for some of your more exciting bullpen parts.
Yeah, well, considering Thatcher hasn't played this year and probably won't play this year, he might actually look about shopping him, but that's still a young player that I look at him and I say, that's Jesse Orozco right there. He could be striking out lefties for the next 20 years if he wants.
Sounds about right. Lefty relievers do tend to have jobs much, much longer than everyone else.
Yeah.
Well, anyhow, that's all I have for this morning. Greg, you have anything else you want to add?
Not specifically. Are there any other thoughts that you want to share with us or any other ideas you have on topics?
You know what? I will point out that you guys are in an interesting position as far as watching the Padres because, you know, coming up this week, you'll get to see the current iteration of the team, what they are now, where it's kind of Chase Headley walks, Ryan Ludwig occasionally hits home runs, Brad Hopp is hitting singles and doubles, but the rest of the lineup is filled up with guys who can't really field, can't really hit, can't really do much of anything. And then come the following week when we'll be in Colorado, it looks like Hopp will probably be in right. Rizzo will be at first. Nick Hundley will be back behind the catcher's plate. And Orlando Hudson will probably be back at second. I don't think Cameron Maven will be back in center yet. But the current iteration of the team is very injured and obviously waiting on Rizzo. But, you know, come the following week, we could have all those guys back plus Rizzo. It could be a totally different team, which is one of the reasons I said, you know, they have a chance to have a really exciting June followed up with a really exciting July. And they could be right in the thick of things come the trading deadline. So those two series are going to be fun to watch and compare to one another, certainly.
All right, John. Well, thanks again for joining us today. Hope to have you back sometime.
No problem at all. Anytime you guys want to have me back, I'd be glad to do it.
Okay, thanks again. All right. right, everyone, that pretty much wraps things up for today. Unless, Andrew, you have anything else that you want to discuss?
I think we've talked about just about everything. It was not too much this week outside of the excitement about Rex Brothers getting called up, and just kind of depressingly more of the same.
Yeah, we haven't had a lot to talk about regarding the actual team itself and how they've been playing. It's just mostly been little news here, little news there, talking about the way the rosters have changed a little bit. And so we'll be back in a week once again. That's going to be Monday, June the 13th. And, yeah, on behalf of the two of us, we'll see you then. Take care.